Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is July the 11th. We are in Ruth, Perek Gimel, Pasuk Zayin, Chapter 3, Verse 7. So we're up to Naomi's plan being implemented, and we said last time we were going to discuss what exactly is Naomi's plan. How does that make any sense? Well, first we're going to read through what happens, and then we'll discuss what Naomi has in mind over here and how this is all working. Vayochal Boaz vayisht. Boaz ate and he drank. Vayitav libo, and he made his heart good, which Rashi explains, Chazal say, that he studied Torah. Vayavo lishkav b'kseho areimon, went to sleep at the edge of the pile of grain. Why did Boaz sleep in the field next to the pile of grain? Is that a place?
It was outdoors?
Well, even if it wasn't outdoors, even if it was in a building, a granary, but still, he was still not in a regular house. So why would he be in a place like this?
To protect it from
Ganuvim? So Chazal say that there was a problem with people stealing things. There were burglars. The generation were Prutzim the Gezel. There was a lot of thievery going on. And he was there to protect the grain. Vatavovat Lot, she came in secret. Vatigal Margalosav, and she uncovered his feet. Vatishkov, and she lay down. So, as we mentioned last time, that's all that happened. She uncovered his feet, and she lay down. It's exactly what her mother-in-law told her to do. Just lie down and go to sleep. Vayihiva chatsi alayla, was in the middle of the night. Vayacharad ha'ish vayila face. And the man became afraid. He trembled. Vayila face. Now vayila face means to wrap around. So vayila face means to grab. So either means that he reached out. He didn't know what there was, something there. He didn't know what it was. Chazal said he was afraid it was a shade, it was a demon. He didn't know what was there. He knew there was something there. He didn't know what it was. He was scared. Mm-hmm. So either it means he reached out and grabbed to see that it was a person, that it was her, or she reached out to quiet him so he wouldn't cry out.
Could it be both?
It could be both. V'hine isha shocheves margalosav, and behold, a woman was sleeping at his feet. Vayomer mi'at, and he said, who are you? It was pitch black. There were no lights. It was the middle of the night, and it was pitch black. He couldn't see anything. He said, who are you? Vatomer, and she said, Anochi Rus Amasecha, I am Rus, your maidservant. Uforastacha afecha ala maska, I want you to spread your cloak or your wing over your maidservant. Ki goel ata, for you are a redeemer. Which is another way of saying, marry me. So Rus says to him, I want you to marry me. Vayomer, Boaz says to Rus, Brucha at l'Hashem biti, blessed are you to Hashem, my daughter. Heitavd chastecho acharon min harishon. Your latest chesed is even greater than your first chesed. The first chesed was what?
Accompanying Naomi
back to Eretz Yisrael. But now your latest chesed of asking that I should marry you is even greater than your first one. Levi'olti leches, not to go acharei habachurim, after the young men, imdal v'imashir, whether he is poor or whether he is rich, that you gave up on going after the young men. Instead you came for me. I'm 80 years old and at the very end of my life, and this is an even greater chesed than what you did for your mother-in-law. Now, what does he mean it's a greater chesed? If he's at the very end of his life, he's going to die very shortly. So what does he need to marry for? He needs companionship? I mean, he's the very, very end of his life.
To extend his name.
Okay, so to have a child. The only reason why Boaz would want to marry at this point is only to have a child. Remember, Boaz had many children. According to Chazal, he had 60 children. Again, we don't know whether that's literal or not, but he certainly had many, many children. They all predeceased him. So he should be a broken man. His wife has passed away. So he has no hope for a future. So the only thing he could hope for would be to marry a woman who is young enough to bear children. he's 80 years old. To marry a woman his age would not be worth it, because what's the point? He's about to die anyway. He's at the very end of his life. And the only reason for him to marry anybody would be to bear children. But what young lady is going to marry an 80-year-old man who's about to die?
Right.
So it's an incredible chesed that he says that, Rus, you're willing to marry me in order to give me an opportunity to possibly bear children before I die. And now, my daughter, do not fear. All that you say I will do for you. For all of the gates of my nation know. Now, what is the gates of my nation?
The Sanhedrin.
The Sanhedrin, the high court, was called the Sha'ar. The Torah itself uses that word to mean based in. The Sha'ar, the gate. It refers to the court. So all of the great sages of my nation know, ki eshes chayil at, that you are a woman of valor. Eshes chayil. Now we know that phrase, as I mentioned in the beginning of Rus, the term eshes chayil is the song that we sing, eshes chayil, comes from Mishlei, from Proverbs. And that actually is written later than this. This is written by Shmuel, four generations before David HaMelech. And who wrote Mishlei, Proverbs?
Shlomo
HaMelech. So the poem or the paragraph Eshes Chayil is made part of Tanakh much later than this. However, the truth is that Eshes Chayil was written much earlier than this, and it was written by whom?
Abraham.
It was written by Abraham Avinu as a eulogy for Sarah. So here he invokes that phrase. That we all know that you are an Eshes Chayil. We pointed out in the beginning of Rus that Elimelech, I'm sorry, Boaz himself is called Ish Gibor Chayil, a man also of strength. There it means strength, but the same word Chayil is used to describe Boaz, and now he's using it to describe Rus. V'ata ki amnam ki goel anochi, and now, though it is true that I am a Goel, that I am a Redeemer, we explained last time a Redeemer means someone who is a close relative to buy the land rather than have it be sold out of the family. But he says, V'gam yesh Goel karov mimeni, but there is a Redeemer who's even closer than me. Who is the Redeemer closer than Boaz?
Tov.
And we'll look on the chart. Let's do that right now, quickly. So we have Nachshon has four sons, Elimelech, Naomi's father, Salma, and Tov. Salma's son is Boaz. And the Redeemer is redeeming Naomi's land. Naomi's the one selling land. Rus, of course, has no land. She's a convert. But Naomi's land. Naomi and Boaz are first cousins. But Tov is an uncle of Naomi. An uncle is a closer relative than a first cousin. So, says Boaz, although I am a Redeemer, it's true, but Tov is a closer Redeemer than me. He comes first. He's first in line, and therefore the mitzvah falls to him first. Lini halayla, sleep tonight. V'hayava boker, and it will be in the morning. Imigalech tov yigal. If tov will redeem you, he'll redeem you. V'imoyach potzagalech, if he doesn't want to redeem you. Ugyalticha nochi, I will redeem you. Chai Hashem, I swear by the name of Hashem. Shichviyara boker, sleep until morning. So the simple meaning over here is, why does he swear? Why is he swearing? Why is he taking oath? So the Medrash says that she was afraid that he was just pushing her off. You're just trying to, you know, talk me out of this. You're not really interested in marrying me. You're just claiming that you're interested in marrying me, but you're saying to someone else first before me in line. So Boaz says, no, I swear by Hashem's name that I will marry you if he doesn't marry you. I'm not pushing you away.
Rabbi.
Yes.
Why do they have to get married? Why can't they be a redeemer?
That's a very good question. That's an excellent question, actually, which many of the commentaries struggle with. What does the redemption of the land have to do with marrying Rus? They're two entirely separate things. So we're going to discuss that. Batishkav margalosav araboker, she slept at his feet until morning. Batakam, she got up, beterem yakir ishes reyehu, before a man can recognize his friend, which means she got up right around the crack of dawn, before it was light enough that a person could recognize somebody else. Why? Why did she get up that early? Really, he got her up that early. He wanted her to leave early. Vayomer, he said, Ali Vadat should not be known ki va'a ha'isha hagara, and that the woman came to the granary. It should not become known that she came here. That would not look good. And therefore, he got her up and had her leave. Before one man can recognize another, it's still light enough to be able to get around, but it's still dark enough that you can't really see what a person looks like. Vayomer, and he said, but before he sent her away, he said, Havi ha-mitpachas asher alayich, bring the mitpachas. What do they translate that as? Anybody? A shawl. The shawl that is on you, ve'achazi va, and hold it. Vatochas ba, she held it. She held it out like this. Vayomad sheish se'orim, he measured 6 barleys. Vayashes aleha, and he put it on her. Vayavo ha'ir, and he came to the city. Now, the question is, what are these 6 barley? So the question is, does it mean 6 measures of barley? The common measure is a sa'a. A sa'a is a huge amount of grain. 6 sa'a is a gigantic amount of grain. And that, Rashi says, is not practical. It's not plausible to say that he would have loaded her up with this huge, this massive amount of grain that she would, you know, lug to the city. So therefore, Chazal tell us, this literally means 6 stalks of barley, which is nothing. What's 6 stalks of barley? So why did he give her 6 stalks of barley? So we'll get back to that. That's very important for what we're going to say. Vatavo el kamosa, she came to her mother-in-law, Vatomer, and her mother-in-law said, Mi at BT, who are you, my daughter? Now that should tip us all off. What kind of question is that? What do you mean, who are you, my daughter?
That means, are you engaged or not?
Okay. So you see that Naomi had... What's that?
Are you a kala?
Okay, so Naomi had a plan over here. She expected something to happen. So when she sent Rus off the night before, she expected that when Rus would come back in the morning, she would not be Rus anymore, or might not be Rus anymore. Who are you, my daughter? Vatagad la.
If she were engaged or married.
She said, who are you? We'll see.
Okay.
Vatagad la, and she told her, meaning Rus told Naomi, all that the man did for her. Again, this should also tip us off. She's not answering the question. Who are you, my daughter? The correct answer is, I am Rus. That's the correct answer. Evidently, that wasn't the question. The question is, what is your name? She wanted to know something deeper, and Rus is answering her by telling her everything that happened, everything that the man did for her. Vatomer, and then, now, here also, this should be a curiosity. We just read that she told her everything that the man did for her. Now that should have included everything. But then the Navi chooses to add that she said, Shesh ha-se'orim o'ela nasali, these 6 barley stalks he gave to me. So evidently that was special. That was something additional to what the man did for her. Ki amari lai, for he said to me, Al tavoi reikom al chamoseich, don't come empty-handed to your mother-in-law. Now again, that doesn't make sense if we're just going to read the simple meaning. Because, so, it's, you know, I don't want you to come empty-handed to your mother-in-law, so I'm going to give you a little gift to bring to your mother-in-law. So you give her 6 stalks of barley? That's not a very nice gift. I mean, you want to give a nice gift. You give a large amount of barley, you give something expensive. You give something, the 6 stalks of barley is nothing. So what do you mean, don't come empty-handed? Evidently, these 6 stalks of barley was something that Boaz knew that Naomi would understand the significance of. And when Naomi asks Rus, who are you, my daughter? And Rus tells her everything that happened, the most significant thing that happened is that he gave her 6 stalks of barley. And that's what Boaz wanted her to bring it to her mother-in-law. Don't come empty-handed to your mother-in-law. What does that mean? Because your mother-in-law sent you here with a plan. Boaz understood it all. When he realized it was Rus, he understood everything that was going on, that Naomi had planned. And he needed to send concrete evidence to Naomi that he was on top of the situation. And he did that by sending 6 stalks of barley. And we'll see how that works out. Vatomer, and she said, Shviviti, sit my daughter, Ana Shetidin Eshi Poldavar, till you know how the thing will fall, which we assume means the thing, meaning is it going to be Tov, is it going to be Boaz? Ki lo yishko ta'ish, for the man will not rest, kim ki lo hadavar hayom, until the thing is finished today. This points to the Ruach HaKodesh, to the divine spirit that Naomi had. Because what is the deeper meaning of this? The man will not rest until the thing is finished today.
He will die.
He's going to die. Naomi knew that Boaz was really on his very, very last breath. He's almost done.
And
she's telling Ruth, the man will not rest. He's not going to die yet. He's almost ready to die, but he's going to see this through. Now, what is happening over here? What is Naomi's plan exactly? We mentioned last time the questions are just how bizarre this whole thing is, that she should send Ruth in the middle of the night and set up a situation which certainly looks very suspect. Now, we know nothing happened, but the situation was certainly ripe for something to happen, and it certainly is there's enough innuendo going on over here that it gives rise for all the secular people who read this to think that something more happened. Well, we know nothing happened, but why would Naomi do this? Why would she set it up like that? So for this, we need to examine the line of David HaMelech, something which we've talked about before when we learned about Yehuda and Tamar, and we're going to here discuss it a little bit more directly. And so a lot of this you may know already, but we're going to put it together into one presentation. Okay, so we've already mentioned that the line that produces David HaMelech, and then the line of David HaMelech, is the most important line, the most important family line, bloodline, that there is in the world. We've already mentioned many times that Adam HaRishon, that the name Adam, Aleph Dalet Mem, stands for Adam, David, Mashiach. Because that is the bloodline through which Hashem brings about His presence in the world. We as the Jewish people are the ones who bring out Hashem's presence in the world, but specifically amongst us Jews, that bloodline from Adam to David to Mashiach is the line that Hashem uses as His way of appearing in the world. Ultimately, the goal of the world is to get to the time of Mashiach, which is when Hashem's presence will be more known in the world. Because that is the most significant line that there is, therefore, it is the line that the Satan wants to undermine as best as possible. Before we talk more about that, let's digress with an understanding of the Satan. What does that mean? The Satan is not an independent player. We do not believe, as the Christians do, that there's some sort of independent entity out there that is there to undermine God's plan. God forbid, there's no such thing. But rather, the Satan was created by Hashem. Another word for the Satan is Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. And its purpose is to make it difficult for us to serve Hashem. Because if it wasn't for it being difficult to serve Hashem, then there would be no reason to reward us for our service. And since Hashem's whole goal is to reward us for our service, therefore, there has to be a Satan. This Satan is there to undermine anything that we're trying to do good. And whenever we're trying to do anything good, he's there to undermine it. So whenever you decide that you want to do a mitzvah, there's always pushback. That pushback is coming from the Satan. The more significant the mitzvah is that you want to do, the more there's going to be pushback from the Satan. And very often we can tell just how important what we're trying to do is because we feel there's great resistance. Either internally we feel it, or there are external issues that are happening that are trying to stop us derail us from our goal. Now, the Satan, therefore, is going to try to keep us from bringing Hashem's presence to the world, because that's really what it's all about. Every mitzvah that we do, its real purpose is for ourselves to reach shleimus, to reach our completion, our fruition. And in so doing, to bring the whole world to shleimus, to completion, to fruition. And whenever there is a mitzvah that can bring the world closer, the Satan wants to stop it. That is the job of the Satan. That's the job Hashem gave him. The most significant bloodline, which will bring out the presence of Hashem, therefore, is a prime target for the Satan. Because if Hashem's presence is manifest, then people will do mitzvahs much more. The less he's manifest, the harder it is to do mitzvahs. The Satan's job is to make it harder. So the Satan's job is to keep Mashiach from coming. One of the ways of keeping Mashiach from coming is to try to undermine the line of David HaMelech. As a result, the line of David HaMelech is full of very questionable relationships. The reason why it's full of very questionable relationships is because since the Satan is there constantly trying to undermine it, it's not going to happen unless there are situations which are very close to being an Avera, but are not. They are very close to the line. Normally, we know, we daven every day, Hashem, don't bring us to a nisayon. Don't give us a test. We don't want to be tested. We want everything to go smoothly. We want to just be able to serve Hashem with no distractions and no temptations to take us away from serving Hashem. We don't want any of that. They do happen. Hashem decides when we are supposed to be tempted and when we're supposed to have an easy time. We are not allowed to bring temptation to ourselves. We have to try our best to avoid it. The Gemara says that if a man is traveling along and there are two roads for him to get to where he has to get to, one road is clear, the other road has women who are not dressed properly, and he walks along the road where the women are not dressed properly, and he closes his eyes so he doesn't look at them, the Gemara says he's Nikra Rasha. He's called an evil man. Evil. You'll say, but what do you mean? Why is he evil? He didn't do this sin. In fact, he resisted the sin. So what's wrong? Because since he put himself in a position of being tempted, that is a Rasha. That's evil. You're not allowed to do that. You have to avoid the temptation if you can. We can't always avoid it. And sometimes it's thrown in front of us. And that's Hashem's way of testing us and getting us to do the right thing. With the line of David HaMelech, of course the players in the line are trying to do everything 100%, just like we all want to do things 100%, and we want to stay as far away from sin as possible. We know that our sages, Chazal, are charged with the responsibility of giving us fences to keep us even further away from the Torah, where the Torah may say you can't eat meat and milk, but Chazal say you can't eat chicken and milk, because chicken and milk are similar to meat and milk, because since a cow has to be slaughtered and a chicken has to be slaughtered, if a bird has to be slaughtered, they're similar to each other. And therefore, one may make a mistake. So we have a rabbinic decree to keep us away from the Torah prohibition. With marriages and relationships, of course, we do the same thing. We don't get close to, God forbid, a sin. We don't want that. We don't want to be close to arayos, to immorality. We want to be as far from that as possible. We want our marriages and our relationships to be as clear and as clear cut and kosher as they possibly can be. But with the line of King David, both before and after, the Satan is trying to push that bloodline to becoming not kosher, to becoming mixed in an immoral fashion. The Satan is trying to make it happen. Since the bloodline is so precious, he's trying to sully that bloodline. He's trying to bring sin into that bloodline. Get a little bit of illicit relationships going on in that line, and that'll destroy the line of David HaMelech. That's why we find many times in the line of David HaMelech, the envelope is pushed right up to the edge, right before the sin, and at the last moment, there's some way that somebody rises to the occasion and does not sin. And there are many examples. The first such example is actually not from the line of David, but it's actually from the line of Rus. And that is? Before that? Where does Rus come from? Lot and his daughters. Lot and his daughters. When you would say, that is the most, that's incest. A father and a daughter? What kind of thing is that? But the daughters honestly believed that the whole world was destroyed when Sodom was destroyed and that they were doing a mitzvah. And they had precedent for it. Because they knew that when Adam and Chava had children, they had boys and girls. Who did they marry?
Each other.
They married each other. There was nobody else. Brother and sister married. And that was permitted because there was no other way of populating the world. When there is no other way of populating the world, incest is permitted. It's almost never applicable. It was only applicable once in history, but the girls, the daughters of Lot, thought that it was applicable again. So even though the act would seem to be a sin, incest, a father and a daughter, it's right up against the line of being prohibited, but because of the technicality, it was permitted. Because they really thought they were the only ones left. Lot knew better, but Lot was drunk. He was so drunk he didn't know what was going on. So there is, that's one example. Then you have Yehuda and Tamar,
right,
which we talked about when we studied about Yehuda and Tamar, where there you have Yehuda, whose wife has passed away, Tamar, who is his daughter-in-law, whose first two husbands have passed away, and Yehuda is preventing her from marrying the third husband with Yibum, with the Leveret marriage, and Yehuda is going to shear the sheep, and Tamar goes, poses as a prostitute, and Yehuda ends up having a relationship with her. Now, we, when we learned that, we studied then, we showed that the verse says, Vateit Eleha El Haderach. Vayet Eleha El Haderach. He turned to her to the road. Yehuda turned and saw her, turned back to the road. Turned and saw her, turned back to the road. He was, Chazal say, he was being pushed. Kafo shade. He was being pushed by a demon, whatever demon means. There was some non-human force that was pushing Yehuda towards her. Yehuda recognized that was going on, therefore he understood there was something bigger than himself, greater than himself, that was forcing him in this direction, and he realized this was the right thing to do. And it was the right thing to do. Yehuda is never criticized for having had a relationship with Tamar, even though we know that the Torah and the Gemara and the Medrash are not afraid to blame and to admonish the best of our people. We never pull punches. Moshe is chastised, as is Abraham, as is everybody. But in this case, Yehuda is not blamed for it because what he did was correct. It was the right thing to do. But it definitely looks funny. It definitely looks bad. And the secular people have a field day with this. That, oh, Yehuda, he was really a licentious person. He wasn't. But again, you have the envelope is being pushed. It's right up against the line. It's almost a sin. But it isn't. Here you have another example of that. Here you have where Naomi has set up a situation. And this is a little bit different because someone is orchestrating this. But Naomi is setting up a situation where Ruth and Boaz look really funny. She's sending Ruth into the field in the middle of the night. Well, she sends her before the middle of the night, but she's there in the middle of the night. She has her uncover his feet and lie down. Well, what do you think is going to happen? So she's creating a real dangerous situation, which is right up against the line for sin. Now, Boaz doesn't do anything, but he was sorely tempted. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But before we do that, I want to give you a couple more cases. We also have the story of David and Bathsheba. David and Bathsheba, there David did the wrong thing. When we study about David and Bathsheba, please God, next year when we learn the book of Shmuel, when we study about David and Bathsheba, we're going to learn that David and Bathsheba is not nearly as bad as people think it was. It was wrong, but it was not adultery. Not only was it not adultery, it was barely a sin. Barely a sin. It was really a very, very subtle sin, but it was wrong. What was going on over there? What was going on over there was a very similar thing. David and Bathsheba were right up against the line of sinning, and they crossed the line. That's the one example we have where the line actually was crossed. We'll talk about that when we learn about David and Bathsheba. We didn't talk about this when we learned Ezra and Nehemiah, but we should have. I just didn't have an opportunity to discuss it. Nehemiah, who is called Zerubbabel, which means that he's a seed that was sown in Babel, in Babylonia. His father, Yechoniah, was not a righteous king. And he was taken into exile, as we know, 11 years prior to the exile of Tzidkiyahu when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. He was put in a pit in the ground. Yechoniah was. He was put in a pit in the ground. And that's where he remained for many, many, many years. He remained down there for over 30 years in a pit in the ground. Finally, with the death of Nebuchadnezzar and his son Evil-Merodach becoming king, he took Yechaniah out of the pit in the ground. Now, when Yechaniah was in the pit in the ground, the line of David HaMelech was precariously close to being extinguished, because Yechaniah's kids were killed, Zedekiah, who was his uncle, his kids were killed. There was really nobody left. There were very few options left of carrying on the line of David HaMelech. And for whatever reason, the Nebuchadnezzar was prevailed upon that he would allow Yechaniah's wife into the pit in order to produce a child, in order that the line of David HaMelech not be extinguished. For the express purpose of that line, he didn't kill Yechaniah, he kept him alive. So he didn't just kill and wipe out the line, but he needed to have a son in order to carry on the line. And she was lowered into the pit. Now, here you have Yechaniah, who is down there for many years by himself, and certainly has not had his wife with him. They didn't have any kind of any kind of visits at all. There was nothing. You couldn't do anything. He was in the pit in the ground. They lowered her down to the ground. She's there, and before anything happens, she says to him that I have become Anida. I'm impure. And Yechaniah, rather than allow himself to be tempted, he said, okay, then the deal's off. And they took her out of the pit. They waited the requisite amount of days until she became pure again, and they lowered her down again. And that it's from that Nehemiah Zerubbabel was born. From that relationship. Which was, again, right on the edge. Right on the edge. And they were sorely tested. The Sutton really made it difficult. Here, my last chance to produce a child. I don't even think that I don't even think that Yechaniah would have been tempted from a temptation point of view. I really think it was more my opportunity, my one sole opportunity to produce a child, to keep that line going. And now she's Anida. He could have said, "Forget it. I'm not paying attention to the law." But he said, "Deal's off." So even though he was not a righteous king before he was put in the pit, but you see that he did rise to the occasion of this temptation. And he did not go forward. She was taken out and brought back later. And that produced the great tzaddik, Nehemiah Zerubbabel, who we learned about most recently.
Wow.
This is the way that the line of David HaMelech goes. You can be sure. I am not a prophet. I am not making a prediction. It just seems to me, from the way things are, we don't know who Mashiach is or will be. We have no idea. But to think that Mashiach is going to be born in the regular fashion without some sort of cloud surrounding his conception would be very surprising. I would imagine that however it's going to happen, there's going to be some suspicion, something going on that will look kind of bad, but in reality, it'll be fine because someone's going to rise to the occasion and not cross the line in order for this to happen. My Rosh Hashiva, Rabbi Weinberg of blessed memory, pointed out a very astute observation that in these cases of the line getting very, very close, one of the things that you find, with the exception of David and Bathsheba, one of the things that you find is that the woman is the one who initiates, which is not according to the natural order. The way Hashem set up the natural order when it comes to relationships, the man is the initiator. That is true from a personality point of view and from all points of view. However, with these stories, the ones I've mentioned, the woman is the initiator. The daughters of Lot initiate. Tamar initiates. She goes, dresses up as a prostitute. It's her idea. With Boaz and Rus, Naomi sends Rus. With Yechaniah in the pit, it wasn't him. They brought her to him. It was coming from the female side, which is completely different than what we would normally expect from a tznius perspective, from a modesty perspective. That's another aspect of it being a little bit unusual, a little bit pushing the envelope. David and Bathsheba, David initiates. My Rosh Hashiva pointed out, that's where you see that a mistake was being made. The fact that it came from him and not from her already tips us off that there's something that's not 100% over there. Well, again, we will study about it, please God, when we get to it in the book of Shmuel. The Naomi over here, and this is the shocking part, Naomi evidently, knowing that the line of David HaMelech was almost extinguished, she knew this. We all know that's what was going on. She knew that her line was finished, her boys were dead, and the no more was going to come. She knew that Boaz's line was done, finished, they were all wiped out. We don't know of any children that Tov had. She knew the line was very close to being extinguished. And she also knew that Rus, who was from Moab, really could be the grandmother, the great-grandmother of David HaMelech. And therefore, she says to Rus, I'm going to send you on a mission, and you're going to go, and you're going to push the envelope. We're going to set you up in a situation where Boaz is going to be sorely tempted, because Boaz is going to know that his life is almost over. And if he wants any future, he shouldn't wait. And he was sorely tempted. The Gemara tells us that Tukfo Shel Yosef, the great challenge of Yosef with the wife of Potiphar, was An Visanuso Shel Boaz, was really nothing for Boaz. What Boaz went through was a greater challenge than what Yosef went through. Why? Because Yosef was dealing with a married woman. But Potiphar's wife was a married woman. And Yosef knew that that would be adultery for him to have a relationship with her. Rus was a single woman. There was no avera of adultery over here, if Boaz would have just gone ahead with it that night. But Boaz knew that it was wrong. Even though every ounce of logic that he had was screaming at him, you don't know you're going to get another chance. It might be all over. She's willing. So what are you waiting for? And that's why Boaz took an oath. He took an oath not to tell Ruth that I will be sure to marry you. He took an oath to say to himself, I will marry you tomorrow, properly. I'm not doing anything now. And he swore by the name of Hashem, I'm not doing anything now. The Gemara says he was sorely tempted. Sorely tempted. And he withstood himself because he knew that you can't cross the line. Even though, we're not talking about a physical urge. We're talking about every ounce of logic that he had was arguing, now is the time. Hashem gave you the perfect opportunity. You could even argue it was like Hashem's doing. He could have said, just like my ancestor Yehuda, it was a prostitute. So over there, and that was the right thing to do. So over here, she's not married. What am I waiting for? I'm 80 years old. I may be dead by tomorrow morning. Let me do it now. No. Didn't do a thing. And he swore, I'm not doing it. And he stopped himself. When it says, Lini Halayla in Yud Gimel 13, sleep tonight, Chazal say, sleep single tonight. Because I'm not doing anything now. I'm not going to touch you now. And then, in the morning, if Tov redeems you, fine. But if not, I will redeem you when? Then. Not now. I swear by the name of Hashem. And he did not cross the line. In the merit of not crossing that line, he merited being the great-grandfather of David HaMelech. Then he will marry Rus, as we know. And he will have a child from Rus. And he will be dead by the morning after he marries Rus. He will get one more night, and that will be the way that he will carry on his line, and he will merit being the great-grandfather of David. But it is because he withstood the temptation over here. The story of Yehuda and Tamar, let's start with the story of Lot and his daughters. Where does that take place, the story of Lot and his daughters?
Outside Sodom.
It's outside Sodom, somewhere, and it's in a
cave.
It's in a cave. It's in a cave in a mountain. Right? It's in a cave in a mountain. Where does the story of Yehuda and Tamar take place?
At a crossroads.
At a crossroads on the way to base... Not to base, excuse me. On the way to... on the way to... Thank you. Timnah. On the way to Timnah. Where did Yehuda live? Where were they? Where were the brothers living at the time? Where were they? So it says they were on the crossroads. It says that Tamar sat on the crossroads. It says Vatesha Pesach Einayim, where the eyes are open. What does that mean, Pesach Einayim? Chazal tell us, our sages say, Bepischo Shal Avram Avinu, on the doorway of Avram Avinu. What does that mean, the doorway of Avram Avinu? Avram Avinu wasn't alive anymore. So some say it means the Eish al Avraham. It means the hotel of Avraham that he had made for passers-by. Others say that it was the Ma'aras HaMachpelah. Mm-hmm. It was where our patriarchs and matriarchs are buried. What about the cave of Lot and his daughters? Well, over there the Torah says, Vayeshev Bame'ara. He dwelled in the cave. Now, he's in a cave near the area of Sodom, near where Abraham was, which was Hebron. And there's a mountain, and there's a cave. And it says, in the cave, with the Hei Hayidia, with the definite article. It could be the same place. And I want to show you that, over here, where was Boaz sleeping? Look in Pasuk Zion, verse 7. You got to look in the Hebrew side. Vayocha Boaz Vayesh Vayitav Libo. Boaz ate and drank, and he made his heart go, which means he studied Torah. Vayavo Lishkav, and he went to sleep. He came to sleep, say, at the edge of Ha'arema, the pile. Ha'arema. Now, Ha'arema, Hey Ayin Resh Mem Hey. Take that Mem and move it over two letters, and you get Ha'mi'ara, the cave. Ha'arema and Ha'mi'ara are almost, they're the same letters. And they're almost in the same sequence. Ha-a-re-ma. Ha-me-a-ra. I'm just moving the mem over. That's all. That Lot and his daughters might have been in the Ma'aras HaMachpelah, might have been there. If that was the cave they were in, which is possible since it uses the definite article. If that's true, imagine now what the daughters of Lot are thinking. The world is destroyed. We're the only ones left. We're it. This is it. And we are in the cave in which? Who's buried?
Adam.
Before that. Adam and Chava. The ones who started the world.
Wow.
We're in that cave. Mm-hmm. And we're the only ones left. It's our responsibility to keep it going. If Yehuda and Tamar, if Tamar was in the Ma'aras HaMachpelah, which is one of these two opinions, if that's true, that she was in the Ma'aras HaMachpelah. Imagine now, Yehuda's on the road. He's traveling along. And he turns, and there's a prostitute. In the Ma'aras HaMachpelah? A prostitute in the Ma'aras HaMachpelah? What would any God-fearing Jew do today if they saw a prostitute in the Ma'aras HaMachpelah?
You kill her.
If they would be able to withstand themselves, they will keep themselves from killing her.
Yeah.
Right? Fine. But they'll scream and yell.
Yeah, they'll kick her out.
They would go berserk. What do you mean? What kind of crazy thing is that? Yehuda sees a prostitute in Ma'aras HaMachpelah. He turns away. He's pushed back. What's going on in Yehuda's mind, you think about it, a prostitute in Ma'aras HaMachpelah, there's something crazy over here. This is not normal. There's something happening. Something big happening. I had a younger chavrusa when I was in yeshiva, when I was in Kol, there was a bracha in the yeshiva, and we used to learn together at night, and his name is Rafi Cohen. He's now an attorney in the Silver Spring area. And when I told him about this thought and explained to him about the cave, if that's where the story of Lot and his daughters happened, and if that's where the story of Yehuda and Tamar happened, then we talked about the story of Boaz and Ruth. And I said to him, it would be very interesting if we could find some indication that this happened in the same place, because after all, Boaz was in Beis Lechem, not far away, could have been. So it would be very interesting if that was true. He's the one who noticed this word. He noticed that, he showed me, that ha'arema, the pile, is the same letters, almost the exact same spelling as ha'me'ara, the cave. Perhaps it would be a similar idea. But it would make sense, because since Adam is buried in the Ma'aras HaMachpelah, and Adam is Adam David Mashiach, then it makes sense for these episodes to take place in and around the Ma'aras HaMachpelah. Now, what's with the six barley stalks? So Chazal tell us that the reason why Boaz gave her six barley stalks is because the pasuk says that Mashiach will have six qualities. V'nachal of Ruach Elokim, Ruach Chachma Obina, Ruach, I don't remember the whole pasuk. But, you have it over there? Rashi brings part of it.
Which pasuk is it?
I'll tell you. One second, hold on. The pasuk says, it says Ruach Chachma Uvina, a spirit of wisdom and understanding. It's not the pasuk in Rus. It's Rashi brings it. Eitza Ugvura, Eitza is understanding, Gvura, strength. Ruach Das Viras Hashem, the Ruach of knowledge and knowing Hashem and fearing Hashem. That pasuk is said about Mashiach. Actually, the Gemara says it was said about several people. It was said about David, it was said about Mashiach, it was said about Daniel, various people, all in the line of David HaMelech. All in David HaMelech's line. So he gave her the six stalks as a remez, as a hint that Rus will have someone come from her that will have these six brachos, these six blessings. When all this thing happened, this whole business happened, remember, Rus had been the potential good bird, Preda Tova, from Moav. But it didn't come to fruition. It didn't work out. Machlon died, Kilion died, Elimelech died, they all died. So now she's just a regular person who is doing chesed for her mother-in-law, and she comes back. And Boaz, in turn, does chesed for her with the collecting grain in the field. That's wonderful. But Boaz doesn't entertain the possibility that Rus is actually going to be that mother of royalty. That was Elimelech's mistake, trying to find that woman. Boaz doesn't do that. Boaz says, this is not my business. That's up to Hashem. But when Rus comes to him in the middle of the night, and he's faced with that challenge, and he knows that Naomi has orchestrated all of this, and he realizes that Rus not only has done the chesed, the kindness of taking care of her mother-in-law, but now you've done even a greater chesed, that you're willing to provide me with a future, even though I'm about to die. Now he says, everybody knows you're an Eishes Chayil. Now we all know you are the one. Elimelech had the right woman. He got the right woman from Moab for his son Machlon. You're the right one. Maybe my uncle did it the wrong way, so he died. And so did my cousin. But you're the right woman. Now I understand that. And therefore, I'm going to redeem you. I can't go first, because it's all about not jumping the gun. Just like I'm not jumping the gun tonight, just like I didn't go to Moab to look for you, that's not the way it works. We got to go according to the book. And the book is the Torah. And the book says that Tov comes first. So I'm not jumping the gun. And I swear, by the name of Hashem, I'm not jumping the gun. So we got to do this right. But I do swear that if he doesn't take you, I'm going to. I will redeem you. I will marry you. And you will end up being the mother of royalty. Because you have demonstrated the chesed that Malchus, that royalty is all about. As we talked about in the beginning of Rus, royalty is all about chesed. And you have demonstrated, you have even greater chesed than before. And now I know you're it. Hopefully it'll be with me, but I can't say that for sure. And therefore, he says, I need to send a sign, even though I'm not marrying you, I need to send a sign to your mother-in-law so she should understand that I know full well you, Rus, are the mother of royalty. You're the Ima Shel Malchus. So he gets her up in the morning, says, go back to your mother-in-law and take with you these six stalks. She comes back to Naomi. Naomi says, who are you? Are you the Ima Shel Malchus? Are you the mother of royalty? I've wanted this so badly, knowing your good heart, knowing your chesed, I know that you could be the Ima Shel Malchus. You could be the mother of royalty. You could be that good bird from Moab. Even though my husband didn't do it right and my sons didn't do it right. But you could still be it. Mi'at, are you? Who are you? Are you the mother of royalty? So Ruth answers, tells her everything that happened, and then she takes out the six stalks. And she says, Boaz gave these to me, telling me, don't come empty-handed to your mother-in-law. And now Naomi understands that Boaz got it. And Boaz is telling Naomi, don't worry, Ruth is the Ima Shel Malchus. It'll either come through Tov or from me. It's going to be one of the two of us. But that's from the man's point of view, from Yehuda's side. But from the Moab side, from the woman's side, it's for sure Ruth. I can tell you that with certainty. That's the message that he sent back to Naomi. And Naomi says to Ruth, okay, sit tight, stay here, because until you know how the thing falls, because the man will not rest until this is taken care of today. And that brings us to the fourth chapter, to Perek Daled, which will be the climax of the whole thing, where Boaz and his uncle Tov are going to have a give and take about Ruth. We still have a major loose end that we haven't cleared up, which Dr. Clary brought up, which is, what does the redemption of the field have to do with marrying Ruth? That we have not clarified. That we have to save for the fourth chapter, as they're going to go back and forth in front of the court about what to do. We will see what the whole discussion is about. But the land, the field, and marrying Ruth are very intertwined. And we will see why they're intertwined and how they're intertwined and why they play such a big role. And we know in the end it's going to be Boaz, but at this point in the story we haven't gotten to it yet. It could either be Tov or Boaz. The woman has been determined. It's Ruth. But who's the man? That's the next chapter. We'll see that Mirz Hashem next time.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.